Welcome, friends and enemies, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Henrik from Sweden. Good to speak with you again, wherever you are in the world. This is Red Ice Radio, independent, alternative radio, commercial-free, and more importantly, listener-supported, which means that we are truly independent. Well, it's a super busy week this week. We're doing several live streams on top of the radio shows. We are going from Monday, July 18th to Thursday, July 21st. We are covering the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. We're going to have guests joining us remotely, and we have reporters on location covering the protests and other events around in Cleveland. RedIce.tv/live has more information for you. And also, of course, check out our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/RedIceRadio. Subscribe to the channel and definitely don't miss it. A lot of good stuff coming up. Well, on today's radio show, we are talking with James Buck about his book Other Losses, an investigation into the mass deaths of German prisoners at the hands of the French and Americans after World War II. Think you know the story of what happened after the war? Well, think again and realize that the Allies were no angels coming to save the day. James was born in Canada, educated at Upper Canada College and Trinity College in Toronto. His books have sold over 25,000 copies in 14 countries around the world. They have been the subject of academic conferences, many articles, and TV documentaries in Canada, the UK, the US, France, and Germany. Well, this is an interesting show, especially to the newcomer to some of the historical revisionism material that is out there. So listen up, and if you find it compelling and want to hear more, definitely check out our archives at redice.tv for much more on these and many other topics that crystallize this idea that most of history is a lie and what you've been told is far, far from the truth. Let's go over to James. All right, welcome, James, back. Thank you so much for coming on. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Hope you're doing well today.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to have this chance.
Excellent. Now, tell us first, what inspired you to write Other Losses?
Well, I was in France looking for a chance to interview Monsieur Laporterie, who is the mayor of a small town in the southwest of France during the Second World War. The Nazis were rounding up Jews and other people to take them away and put them into work camps in the east, where many of them died in terrible conditions. So he was a friend to everybody, because he was non-discriminatory. He helped his friends, and he saved about 1,600 lives from the Germans during the war.
And tell us a bit more about that. How did that enable you to discover some of the material that you did for Other Losses?
It was very strange. In the pigeonnier, as he called it, or the archives of this man, Laporterie, there were a series of letters in crude French from people with German names and with dates like 1947, 48, 49, 50, 60, 70. Many of them very friendly letters in this French. And it was obvious that he had German friends. And I wondered, how could he have German friends if he had been at war with them? He'd been a prisoner in the First World War. He had every reason to hate them, and he didn't. He was befriending them, obviously, and they were grateful to him. So I went to see these two men, or at least I tried to. One of them was named Adam Heil, and one of them was named Hans Gertz. And Heil refused to see me, but Hans Gertz said, yes, I'll give you an interview about Monsieur Laporterie. So I went to see him.
And give us a bit more about that. What happened next?
Well, he was obviously a very solid, stolid, unimaginative sort of a person. He was a bus conductor, streetcar driver, tram driver for a lot of his life after the war. But during the war, he was in the Wehrmacht, and he was captured at the end of the war and sent to a prison camp in France. And at the end of the interview, I said to him, well, that's about it. Is there anything else for you to say? And I turned off the tape recorder, and he noticed that. And now he got confiding with me. And you could maybe take a tip from this, Henrik, in your interviewing. When the tape recorder is turned off, you're going to hear the thing you really wanted to hear
most.
Oh,
I know. It's happened many times. Trust me. It's like, yeah. I should have recorded that. It's true.
Isn't that unusual?
Yeah.
At any rate, there I was, and he was looking at me and saying, I can tell you, Monsieur La Porterie is my friend. And I said, well, yeah, I can see that, of course. And he said, no, I mean something special. He saved my life. And I said, oh, how did he do that? I was packing up and getting ready to go. And he said, well, he took me out of that prison camp. And I said, thinking, you know, prison camp, all it is boring and bad food. And he said, no. It was deadly. 25% of the men in that camp died in 1 month. And I said, what did they die of? And he said, cachexie, inanition, crève faim. Starvation, cachexie, and sickness and malady. So I said, I can hardly believe that. What? Tell me more. But he wouldn't. And this was exactly Adam Heil's reaction, his friend. He wouldn't talk about it either. And this man had just suddenly broken surface, but then he couldn't do it anymore. He had to shut up.
Remind our audience again, what year was this? When did you meet with these gentlemen?
I met with them in about the year 1986. Only one of them, Mr. Gertz. The other one, Heil, wouldn't meet me. And of course, Monsieur La Porterie met me many times.
So only 3 years later, your book comes out. Tell us what happened in that period.
Well, I couldn't believe what was happening, what he told me. I couldn't really believe it. So I went back to La Porterie in the south of France, and I said to him, I've heard about this prison camp from Monsieur Gertz, and I'd like to know more. And he said, what would you like me to do? And I said, well, are there any people around here who know anything about the camp? And he said, yes, many of them. Is there an aumônier, which is the padre of the camp, or the chaplain? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I'll get in touch with him, and so on. And so I went to see him, and I asked him about the deaths. He should have been burying all these men and saying prayers over them. And I said, how many were there? And he shifted, and his eyes looked uneasy, and he didn't want to tell me. So I persisted. I kept after him. And finally, he said, oh, not very many, or I don't remember. I don't remember. He didn't want to know. He didn't want to say. And so I realized there was something really sick here, because he couldn't bring himself to say anything about it. And he pretended to forget, and then he remembered, and then he denied, and, you know. Finally, Monsieur La Porterie helped me by telling me that he could find some guards who lived in the south of France nearby and had been drafted into the French army after the end of the war, which would have been for them in the middle of 1945. And this meant that they were back in the army again if they'd never been in it. And they were to be guards in a camp called Bouglos, right near Monsieur La Porterie's hometown, which was south of Bordeaux. And so he arranged for me to meet a couple of these gentlemen in a farm kitchen nearby. Most of the men around there were farmers. And when we got to the farmyard in the car, I had a research assistant with me. The cars were just jammed in the lot. I could see there were maybe 15 or 20 people in the house who just filled this little kitchen. And we went in there, and they told me the story of the camp.
So they, as far as you were concerned at that point, they had never talked publicly with other journalists or reporters about this. I can imagine they've spoken maybe with their family and friends or something, but not publicly, right?
That's a very good point. They would speak to each other, not much to their family, and to nobody else.
Was that simply due to the horrors that they... I mean, that's a classic, you know, problem, if you will, that we tend to compartmentalize as humans, and we kind of store away those memories that are just simply too horrible. Many that come back from war, they just don't talk with their spouses or family about it. Is it a similar scenario here?
That's a very good approach to it. Yeah, it's all of those things. First, it's compartmentalization, as you say. Don't want to face the horrors. But it was also that was reinforced by Allied propaganda. During and after the war, the Germans were monsters. And to quite a few people, even today, they still are monsters. If the subject of the Second World War comes up, or of the German camps in the East.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is something I want to get into more detail with you later, and kind of as we analyze some of that. But tell us a bit more here then, because, okay, so you've discovered some of the testimony here, if you will. You've started to uncover something which is largely at that point unknown, I would say, to the world. What are some of the sources that you... eventually came to kind of underline these testimonies that became part of your book?
Very good. The sources were mainly the prisoners and the guards, and the tears in their eyes when they had to talk about the camp. That convinced me completely. Nobody could have faked after 50 years tears of emotion over something that had not happened. Obviously, they were telling the truth. Obviously, there had been an absolute catastrophe in that camp, and as I discovered, several camps nearby. So there were more than one. So it wasn't just one bad camp commander. It was obviously symptomatic of a larger problem. So I went to Vincennes, which is the French army archive headquarters in Paris, and I began to look around there.
Before we talk more about what you found there in the document-wise and how much the respective militaries had documented about this, Allied, and also, of course, I think you went to some of the Soviet archives too, but describe for us those who simply don't know anything about what you're talking about here. Give us an overview. Give us a picture of what happened after the Second World War to the German military men.
About 11 million German military people, including women and boys and very old men, around 11 million were taken prisoner by the Allies, who were the United States, Canada, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union, and the Poles, of course, a little bit. And they were herded into camps. Most of those prisoners, about 7 million prisoners, were taken by the Americans, British, and Canadians. Sorry, Americans alone. The British and Canadians took about 2 million more, and the French and the Soviets took around, between 2 and 3 million, whatever's left over there. Not very many, compared with the others. The great majority were in Western Europe, and the ones in the American camps suffered the most. They were herded into open fields. They were surrounded with barbed wire, surveyed by guards with machine guns and tanks and bulldozers, and they were left to starve. They had no food. They had no tents. They had no medical attention. They didn't even have water in many of those camps.
Now, why did this interest you so much? I mean, I would figure today, due to, I would say, how one-sided the history is about specifically about these kinds of occurrences, these types of atrocities, I think many would reason that, well, who cares that Germans were suffering? They were causing so much suffering that whatever happened to them, they kind of deserved it. How, did you have any kind of internal dialogue like that? Did you struggle with any of this? Or tell us more about that.
Yes, very much so. During the First World War, my father joined up right away, a Canadian, and he joined up in August of 1914, within a few days of the start of the war, and he fought for the whole war for the Allied side in France, and then came back to Canada afterwards. In the Second World War, he was he served in the government, doing government war work for $1 a year, and my big sister and my two big brothers both joined up. My big sister joined the Royal Canadian Air Force Women's Division and went to England and commanded all the women on a big bomber base. And my brother was in a sub chaser in the North Atlantic and then in a mine sweeper at D-Day going into the shore to clear the path for our troops. So I had a great deal invested in the war and in the sense of my family being destroyed, because, of course, I didn't see any of these people for years when I was just a kid. And I hated the Germans, and I hated Hitler for that reason.
So what did you feel when you started to discover some of this? Did you started to empathize with the German with the Germans as well?
Not for a long time. All I did at first was to realize this was a great big hidden story. And I was, after all, a writer writing a book, and I could see this would fill books, as it eventually did. And what I needed to do was to find the evidence on documentary paper, which I had to do and did. And then, but the empathy with the Germans came much, much later and is still occurring, because that hatred that was planted in me when I was a kid took a long time to uproot and get rid of.
Yeah, remarkable. All right, so tell us about, I mean, we'll get into Eisenhower here later. There's so many more things we need to deconstruct here. But let's talk about the documents that you did find. I guess you went to American sources, you went to other allied French and British sources. Tell us about those first and what you found. What were some of the official documentation here?
Well, I went to the French Army archives. I didn't find much there, but enough that it was obvious that they were hiding something. So the first thing that I encountered was the cover-up. And the cover-up proved that there was something to cover up, if you follow me.
Yes.
And that having convinced myself that this was worth investigating, I had to disregard the propaganda, which was evident quite soon. The Germans themselves investigated why so many prisoners did not come home after the war, and they published a whole series of books, which I found very frightening at first, because it meant that all my research up to date had been canceled. There were all these books by German scholars saying everything was fine in these camps, don't worry about it. But then I thought, well, why would they publish a book saying a thing like that? If everything had been fine, tickety-boo, as the English might say, if everything had been fine, why would they bother with these books? So I began to inspect them and realized there were all kinds of holes and faults and flaws in them. And then I went to Washington and found documents there, but not just the documents. I found a man. His name was Colonel Dr. Ernest F. Fisher. He was a an American working at that time in 1986, having just retired from the Center for Military History of the United States Army. He was a colonel in the Army writing official history. He could not have been a better placed man and higher in the hierarchy. He knew his stuff. And he said, yes, I've always suspected something like this. Let's go to work. So we went to the archives, and one of the first things we discovered in the archives was an archivist friend of Ernie Fisher, who'd been working on American Army history. And this man, Eddie Reese, said, Well, we're going to have trouble because most of these documents were destroyed in the 1940s.
Right. So you told us about, if I got the numbers right, about what, 15 to 16 million total, 11 to the Allies, 2 million to France, was it? And then to Soviet, something like that.
About 11 or 12 million soldiers and sailors and airmen were captured and imprisoned, and most of them were in very bad shape in their camps. Close to 2 million died, and they were in the Russian and American camps. That's where about 90% of the prisoner deaths occurred. French, at least American and Russian camps, with another few hundred thousand in the French camps.
Now, one of the issues here is the classification of these prisoners, right? That they actually they call them disarmed enemy forces. They changed a designation. For example, the Red Cross could not go and inspect these camps, internment camps, in the way that the Germans had allowed their prisoners of war and their war camps to be inspected. Was this one of the ways that they managed to get away with it, or how did they manage to, how do I put this? How did they manage to do something like this without the bureaucracy, the system in place preventing this, if you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Well, first, they prepared the ground legally, and this showed how carefully they prepared their vengeance under the Morgenthau Plan. The first thing they did was to consult army lawyers who said, well, you better get rid of the Geneva Convention applying to our camps. And they did that simply unilaterally by saying to the army officers, the State Department and the states, now run by Hillary Clinton, or lately by Hillary Clinton, simply issued an order to the army saying the Geneva Convention will not apply. If you call these prisoners not prisoners of war, but disarmed enemy forces. So just by typing out a memo, hundreds of thousands of prisoners were condemned to death.
Yeah. Wow. It's remarkable. Let's talk a bit about Eisenhower's personal motivations. I mean, there's been a tremendous pushback from many people within those who are trying to salvage Eisenhower's name, if you will. When your book came out, there's been a lot of criticism. We can talk more about that later. But what would you describe him like, and his personal investment, if you will, in this whole atrocity?
Well, I can't speak for another man. I can only describe his actions and the results of the actions. So I don't know exactly what it was, but he must have hated them. How could you do such things to people without hating them? And he said himself in a letter, which I've read in an archive, he said himself in a letter to his wife, God, I hate the Germans.
Yeah, that's right.
So his actions speak louder than any other, in his own words, speak louder than anything I could say.
Tell us a bit about the Morgenthau Plan and how that kind of coupled with what happened after the war.
The President of the United States in that period was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he was very eager to get the Americans into the war, and he succeeded. He got them into the war when they didn't really want to be there, and they didn't really know why they were in the war, but they were there. And his best friend, or his guy who said he was Roosevelt's best friend, was Henry C. Morgenthau, who was the Secretary of the Treasury. And he tried to push Roosevelt into a policy of vengeance against the Germans. And he wrote out a plan called the Morgenthau Plan, later published in a book, but presented in a memo first to Churchill and Roosevelt at their meeting in Quebec City in 1944, when the Allies were on the verge of winning the war. And he got them to sign off on a memo saying that they would destroy German industry, that they would prevent the Germans from having trade with the rest of the world. They would turn the country into one big prison. They would rob the Germans of the best of their farmland in the east, which meant Brandenburg, Silesia, Prussia, Pomerania. And that was great farmland and a lot of coal mines too, and handed all over to the Russians and the Poles, and turn all the occupants, who were all Germans, into refugees streaming into the remainder of Germany, who in 1944 numbered about something over 60 million people. They added in the last 15 million people there.
Yep.
And they were all starving and penniless, and they were not allowed to grow their own food. That was part of the Morgenthau plan, to deprive the Germans of fertilizer as well as other things. So millions of civilians died under the Morgenthau plan. So the total death toll was far more than the prisoners. The prisoners died to the number of maybe 2 million. There were 6 million people dead, according to Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, in about 1946. He made a speech in, 1949. He made a speech in the Swiss Parliament in Bern, where he was allowed to tell what he knew. And that was 6 million people more on top of the prisoners. That's 8 million. And there were millions more among the refugees. The German name for them is Vertriebene. And so there is something over 10 million people deliberately exterminated by the Allies after the war, while we were the victors and we had no fear of the Germans taking war against us anymore.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely remarkable. It's horrific, absolutely horrific. I can't even begin to imagine what the conditions were like and how long many of these people had to endure this as well. Because as you say, from 1945 all the way, I believe, up to 1949, these open-air prisons, these death camps were operated. Tell us a bit more about the conditions there in terms of what they... I guess we can talk about what they didn't have, because they didn't have access to anything, as you say, not even water, but no shelter, no... Some of them didn't have blankets or overcoats. They were here, obviously, around all the year seasons, right? So during winter, cold winters, and then blistering summer heat, right?
Yes, that's right. But the open-air camps did not last all that time until 1949. Conditions were extremely bad, but they weren't that bad. The open-air camps lasted until about Christmas of 1945, in other words, about 8 months after the end of the war. Most of the prisoners who were still alive at that point were confined to barracks in under shelter in France or other places, but they didn't have enough food and they didn't have medical attention and so on. So they were dying, but in slightly reduced numbers. The dying rate slowed right down for the prisoners by around September, October, November. But the death rate in the country itself went way up. It was about 10 times in Germany what it had been before the war, the annual death rate.
Yeah. Now, the Red Cross, as we said earlier, didn't have access to inspect and whatever. Well, did you manage to find anyone at that time that had been vocal and concerned about this, or was this completely under the rug for all those years?
No. At the time, Chancellor Adenauer spoke out. And he was reprimanded, but he was not removed from office. He was reprimanded. But what happened from then on was that the allies who could license the newspaper publishers and the school texts and the radio and TV would threaten anyone who published on this subject any truth about these camps. and the Allied imposition of starvation conditions between 45 and 50 would lose their license. So it was worth your life and your livelihood to take on a book or a magazine or anything that said what really had happened. So everything was pushed under the rug and concealed and hidden, and lies put in place. For instance, the books that I told you about, to the number of about 20, that were published that said everything was okay in the camps, were published by the German government in the 1970s after we restored self-government to them. The books were published by the government, as I say, having been taken away, confiscated from German professors and writers, and made to fit into Allied foreign policy, because this was the West German government, and West Germany was our ally. And so Willy Brandt, later the Chancellor of West Germany, who was the foreign minister at the time, took over this series, made it say what he wanted it to say, which was, the Allies are good guys, the Germans are criminals, and the Russians did all the death dealing to the prisoners and civilians after the war. And that became the official line, as laid down in the Bundestag and supported by these books.
I see.
And that's the way it is now in Germany.
Right.
If you take up this line and say what happened really in Germany, you could be accused of the Auschwitz Lüge or the Auschwitz lie, which is to some degree saying that anyone who says that Germans suffered after the war is simply a Nazi sympathizer and is an anti-Semite and a warmonger.
Right.
It's insane, but right. There it is.
Yeah. I heard, James, that this is by law determined historically what happened. There is a narrative, and I don't know exactly what that narrative is. I would assume that it's very much according to the mainstream version that we get to us about the war, about National Socialism, etc., both in from the academic history books to the movies and documentaries that are made by this about this. But I heard that there is a law determined, this is what happened, and if you speak against that, that is breaking the law, right? And therefore, you will be reprimanded in some way.
That is the same thing in Canada and all over the Western world, to some degree. For instance, there's a revisionist historian called David Irving, who has freely entered Canada for many years, and then about 10 years ago, having made a speech in Niagara Falls, he was arrested by the Canadian police. He was put in handcuffs. He was put on a plane and deported from Canada and never allowed to return.
Yep.
Mainly what he was doing was talking about the real origins of the war, for which the Germans have been blamed 100%, and for which some Americans and some Brits and some French and some Poles also bear responsibility. But you can't say these things without being accused also, as I was recently after one of my speeches, of moral equivalence. So I said to the man, he stood up at the end of my speech and said, I'm a Jew and I'm worried about your speech because you seem to be too close to moral equivalence.
Right.
So I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, I mean, he stammered for a long time, and then he said, well, I don't know, and he sat down.
Hmm.
That's what is being used. This was a university professor at the University of Toronto who said this.
Yep.
He was being recorded at the time, and he said this to an assembly of 70 academics.
Yeah. Why do you think, though? I mean, okay, that there is a victim narrative here that's run on top of it, in order to Well, there's many different reasons for it, but one is obviously to continue to demonize Germany even to this day. Is that the main reason why they're so concerned about any of this material getting out? I mean, after all, this was the quote, good war, right? I mean, and this, it would be justified, you would think, in their view, that whatever happened to these Nazis was justified. These were considered to be monsters. They were not human. This would even include women and children, I think. I mean, this is more or less the narrative that we get to us today through the movies and entertainment and even documentaries, right? So what are they afraid of?
So many people have got so much invested in this, in family histories, in personal histories, in national histories, in money and in belief and so on. But the thing that animates most people is their beliefs. What moves their spirit to believe. And those beliefs are almost impossible to shake once they're established. And in this case, the belief is that the British Empire was good, the French Empire was good, all the Americans are good, and so on and on and on. This system also says that the Germans were evil. They started the First World War, and the Second World War was just a continuation of it. And most of that is wildly exaggerated. The skein of truth that's in it is also too weak to bear the consequences that are attributed to it. For instance, A.J.P. Taylor, a great historian and an Englishman, said that the main problem of both wars was simple. It was the British and British and Germans trying to see who's to be master. Who's to be master? That's really all it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Tell us about what happened when your book came out and how this was received. I mean, it did ruffle some feathers, to say the least. How was it treated? And we can talk about some of your critics and how the academics have tried to consequently destroy much of what is in the book. But give us an overview of this.
Well, the book was a big shock at first to most historians and academics. And it was a great cry of relief in Germany. Millions of people were moved by this. The book sold hundreds of thousands of copies. There were many hours of television interviews and many yards of newspaper interviews in print and so on. So it was a big shock, and the German academics at first were somewhat credulous. They believed it more or less, but then they began to gather their forces and say, well, we've been wrong all along. We better prove that this guy is wrong. So it was divided up about, I couldn't say how many, but thousands of ex-prisoners wrote to the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and to Die Welt and other places saying that we were in those camps, and we know that what Mr. Back says is true. And also many, many hundreds of letters to me personally and phone calls, and people would come to the door of my house and say thank you. And so that was in Germany. In France, they just total shut down. They would not believe anything. And the book, when I went to find it in a bookstore, the book was hidden under a table. They were afraid to let people know, passing the window, that they would have such an awful man as Back in their store, especially given that I have a French name, which in England it sold fairly well, but not very well. And they refused to publish it at all in the States. And in Canada, it was a big bestseller. And it's gone on to sell around the world hundreds of thousands of copies.
Yeah, I mean, there was, I think it was Stephen Ambrose, right, who initially expressed understanding for the book and agreed on many points, although it wasn't too, you know, too, he wasn't admitting to all of it. He said, well, there's some flaws here and there, but he, as far as I could tell, retracted this later and basically went along to kind of attack the content of the book. Is that correct?
That's right. That's exactly right. And I don't know why he had such a volte-face, but I do know that just before he changed his mind and went public with this, he was named a professor and teacher at the United States Army War College in Pennsylvania. And presumably the Army officers there got after him and said, Steve, you can't do this. You look at us. I mean, we're wonderful people. And you've said yourself, Eisenhower's a great man running around. So you've got to do something about this. You've gone off course. You've gone a bit crazy. And you better turn around and attack back. It's not too late. And I guess that's what's happened. I can't think of any better reason, but mm-hmm. he certainly was weird with the fact that he supported me and then flipped over and attacked me.
Well, I think that implies, and we can talk more about this in the second segment, but I think it implies that there is an interest from a bigger force, if you will, above him in terms of academia and history and all these kinds of things, that they must keep this narrative in place and in line. But before we talk about where people can get copies of the books and whatnot, you have a documentary film coming out as well. I think it's been worked on this year, correct? Tell us about that a bit.
Well, there is a documentary film. It's entitled Other Losses. It's going to be available on DVD in both the PAL format for Europe and England, unless they secede with Brexit from the PAL format, too. I don't know about that.
Right.
And in North America on the NTCL. And it's in both German and English at the moment, and it'll be in other languages soon, I hope. And you can buy it. People can buy it, if they would, please, from me at my website, jamesback.com. And please do buy it. It's an education and a contribution to my further research. And in the PAL version, it's available from Kiefhauser Verlag in Mengerskirchen in Germany. And that'll be up on your screen, I believe. You're going to be showing these websites, I believe. And
yes, we're going to have links you know, to them on the program page. And one of the things I wanted to note here, too, is obviously that the trailer for the film, we'll add a link to this so people can take a look at it. It shows much of this. There's much of this that was filmed, not everything, of course, but the open-air prisons are there. You have testimony in the film from people who were both serving in the U.S. Army and also civilians on the German side. So it's very, very revealing, and people can actually see this for themselves. It's not something that's made up, you know.
That's right.
It's remarkable. How did you come across some of that footage? Is that military archives in the U.S., or who had that material, by the way?
Well, some of it is, the U.S. Army Signal Corps, and some of it is new footage that we made with survivors of the camps, and that's really very moving, some of that stuff. The what was in the U.S. Army military archives, believe this or not, it's just bizarre. The Americans filmed some of their own atrocities and atrocities by other people against Germans, and they put them in 35mm color photography, and they were developed at the Eastman Kodak Company in Rochester, New York, and our film researchers went to the U.S. Army Signal Corps archive, and they opened the cans. Believe it or not, they had never been viewed.
Really?
So there's miles of this footage, and they had to go through it all and take a look and see and get it copied and put it on. It's all in the public domain, and anybody can go and see this stuff. So that's what we used as the basis for the contemporary footage, 35 mil color.
Wow, excellent. Now, okay, so we have the book, of course, Other Losses, then we have the documentary by the same name. You also have, I guess this is a follow-up book called Crimes. I want to ask you about this in the second hour, but Crimes and Mercies, right? This is more of the civilian side of things. Is that correct?
More or less, yeah.
And these are available, of course, at the website that James mentioned, James Back, and that's spelled James, BACQUE.com, JamesBack.com. We'll have that link up. It's also on Amazon. Was there any other websites that you would like to give out to the audience? I know you're redesigning the website too, right? So there'll be a new version of it up soon too.
The new version of the website is going up, I think, tonight. That's right. And when I say tonight, I mean Monday, July the 11th. I believe this might be rebroadcast later on. Yes, talonbooks.com. I'd like my publisher in Vancouver to be mentioned, and you can buy the book via him. Talon is spelled T-A-L-O-N, books, B-O-O-K-S, talonbooks.com, and Keith Hauser Verlag. I hope you'll put that in print. It's the books are available in German. The film is available in the German and English version from Keith Hauser, and the other books are available in German with many illustrations from Pour le Mérite, P-O-U-R, le Mérite, M-E-R-I-T-E. It's French, but it's the name of a publishing company in Kiel in Germany. And you can put the email address for that company and the website address on your video version of this.
Yeah, we have a program page too, folks, that we'll have the links up on. So definitely check that out. All right, very good. We're going to take a short break here, and then we're going to continue and talk more with James in the second segment. I have much more I want to ask him about. I do want to ask him about the newer books as well. I know that he's written some novels as well, so I hope we can get a chance to just talk about that as well. But stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, James. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back after that.
Praise the Lord, pass the ammunition. Praise the
Do you want to hear the rest? Well, please support independent media by signing up for a membership with us and tune into this and all of our previous shows in full. First hour is always free. Our show is also commercial free. And the second hour is exclusive for members. Now, with a subscription, you also support an alternative independent radio show and a growing live TV channel that is just starting to get the wheels moving. And with that subscription, you also get access to well over 1,000 radio shows on a myriad of topics that has interested us over the years and condensed down to what we today find to be among the most important and pressing, as the enemies of Western civilization and all of mankind are moving so fast and transforming things so rapidly. Now, these topics include European survival, identity, culture, as we fight the globalists, the cultural Marxists, the monocorporatists that are pushing mass immigration. And this is not only leading to the erosion of culture and identity, but also to violence, unrest, and countless other problems, as we now can see in Europe, America, and around the Western world. So inform yourself so that you can make better decisions on how to act and what to do. So definitely sign up for a membership with us. It's only €6 per month. We have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years available. The website is redicemembers.com. That's our website where we have all our content listed from our start in 2006. So stay tuned. James Buck is coming up next. Much more to discuss when it comes to the Allied war crimes after the Second World War. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for listening.